Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Don McGrath, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for tonight's program. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce my friend and today's speaker, John Hope Bryant, the author of Love Leadership, A New Way to Lead in a Fear-Based World. John is the founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of Operation Hope, which he describes as America's first nonprofit social investment bank. The organization is an international provider of economic empowerment tools and services for underserved communities. John was born in Los Angeles and raised in Compton in the south central portion of LA. After Santa Monica High School graduation in 1984 and a few years spent working in the financial services and entertainment industry, he founded Operation Hope in 1992, just following the Rodney King riots. His entrepreneurial idea was the creation of the concept of a silver rights movement, one that would provide the financial knowledge, training, and tools that disadvantaged communities needed to expand economic opportunity and fully participate in the American dream. John and Operation Hope's message of empowerment and hope caught on. And with partnerships and innovative programs, Operation Hope grew quickly, first in Los Angeles and California, and soon across the U.S. In 1994, as a result, John was selected by Time Magazine for their December America's 50 Most Promising Leaders of the Future cover story. Today, John leads an organization that operates programs directly or with partners in 69 U.S. communities. With a focus on financial literacy, the organization's innovative programs have trained and counseled over 1.2 million people in recent years and raised more than $500 million for literacy from the private sector. In the midst of last year's financial crisis, Operation Hope convened a first annual global literacy summit in Anacostia, just outside Washington, D.C. Over 850 delegates from 40 countries attended, and speakers included Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, FDIC Chair Sheila Bair, and civil rights icon Ambassador Andrew Young. In January of 2008, consistent with John's constant force of move forward in literacy, he convinced our then President George Bush to create a special counsel, and John acted and was appointed by President Bush as the vice chairman of the bipartisan U.S. President's Advisory Council on Financial Literacy. He also serves on the Global Agenda Council for the World Economic Forum and as an advisor on financial leadership and empowerment. John and his wife, Sheila, live in Atlanta and L.A. Now, please join me in welcoming the man President Bill Clinton described in his book, Giving, as a, quote, whirlwind of ideas and action, completely positive in his belief in the potential of poor people to prosper with a hand up, not a handout. John Hope Bryant.
Good evening. Oh, I'm sorry. We need to start over. You see, I'm from the black church, and I'm used to seek and respond. So I'm not here to talk at you. I'm here to talk with you. Good evening.
Good evening.
And now you're all honorary black people. Don, as well-dressed as Don is right now, as he typically always is, I've always thought Don was an honorary brother. When Don was racking the gavel, it took me for a minute, sort of startled me, and it sort of harked back to traffic court in Compton, California. This is a much more august surrounding. I'm honored to be here today. I'm honored to be with the Commonwealth Club. I see a couple dear friends here. I want to acknowledge Michael Shepard, the CEO of Bank of the West, one of the largest banks in the nation, and thanks for being here. It is notable that you ran your institution with a great deal of integrity in this crisis, as did Don when he was there. So thank you for trying to figure out how to do well and do good, too. In my book, Love Leadership, The New Way to Lead in a Fear-Based World, I say essentially that there are two things. There's love and there's fear. And what you don't love, you fear. And the reason that this world is all screwed up is that most of our so-called leaders have led by fear. I started out my informal, what will be informal, but hopefully very substantive comments, making a joke about race by inferring that we're all in this together, that we are all actually one. Deepak Chopra has said, we're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience. And I think that humor sometimes can be a great antidote and a great way of making a point without putting it in your face. I guess my real point is that we really live in our comfort zones. Given either a crisis or great humor, we typically don't break out of those comfort zones. We like being comfortable. And so I really believe that rainbows only follow storms. It is not only a nice antidote, it actually happens to be a scientific fact that you cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. This nation has had many storms. And if you think about the burst in creativity, the burst in innovation, the burst in progress, as we've gone from the agricultural age to the industrial age to the technology age to the information age, and what comes next. None of it came easy, and none of it came quick. I want to talk very briefly about three things, and then we're going to have some times for Q&A. I want to talk about where we have come from. I want to talk about where we are now, and then I want to talk about my vision and hopefully our shared vision for the future. But before I do that, let me get personal for a moment. I grew up in Compton, California, and in South Central Los Angeles. My mother told me she loved me every day of my life. There's nothing more powerful than a child being told that they are loved by their mother. And from that, I gained this saying that has become famous, but people I don't think understand how personal it is to me, that there's a difference between being broke and being poor. That being broke is economic, but being poor is a disabling frame of mind and a depressed condition of your spirit, and you must vow never, ever, ever to be poor again. If you think about it, people that we know who are doing badly, particularly people in low wealth communities, but these days, even if you are middle class, you feel poor. Can I get an amen? The Federal Reserve had said even before this crisis that 70% of Americans were living from paycheck to paycheck. They didn't say 70% of black people or 70% of Latinos or 70% of Caucasians, even though there are more poor people in America than more poor white people in America than poor anybody else. They didn't say 70% of Asians or Indians or any other group. 70% of all Americans were living from paycheck to paycheck. If you lived in a major city like New York or San Francisco and made less than $50,000 a year, you were struggling to make ends meet. If you were living in a small town, and America's mostly small towns, and made less than $35,000 a year, you were struggling to make ends meet. And so while the civil rights movement was really an issue of race and the color line, what I call the silver rights movement will be more an issue of class and poverty. Whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow, today you just want to see some more green. So when I was coming up, my mom and my dad, they loved each other passionately. They were really good for each other in many ways. But my mom and dad fought over money. The number one cause for divorce in America today is money. The number one reason for domestic disputes in America, you as a police officer, what they don't like responding to. It is not a shootout at a bank branch. It is a domestic dispute, because it is in a domestic dispute where they get hurt. And most domestic disputes are grounded and rooted in conflicts over money. Number one reason why black and brown college students drop out of college is not academics, it's money. And I can go on and on and on. Half those in foreclosure today never picked up the phone and called their lender. Think about that now. It wasn't that they called the lender and they got a bad response. Half those in foreclosure never picked up the phone and called their lender. And so it's not just that we are financially illiterate, it's that we are ashamed. It's that we are ashamed to admit we don't understand money, because money is emotional. Money is aspirational. It deals with your self-esteem. If you have low self-esteem and you're also financially illiterate, you'll run yourself into an economic ditch trying to look like your next-door neighbor. Back to the story. My mother had no self-esteem problem, worked a job for most of her life, but she would say that the man will set your salary, but you decide your income. And my mother today has bought and sold 5 homes and lives in Houston, Texas, and will tell you that she wants a man but doesn't need a man, and if she gets a man, he's going to be a BMW, a black man working. My mom and dad, my dad has owned a business for 54 years. I'm so proud of the man he is, and because of him, I'm an entrepreneur. I started my first business when I was 10 years of age. You know, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want to be stupid. I want to be a failure. I want to be a drug dealer. I mean, think about it. This is my childhood ambition. Ooh, let me be dumb. Let me be a drug dealer. The reality is that these kids that grow up in these communities that end up as rap stars, athletes, or drug dealers are brilliant. I'm going to let that sit in for a moment, because I didn't always believe this. I thought these kids were dumb and stupid and lazy, and I would say, get off your rear end, go get a job, stop whining, what's your problem? I grew up in Compton, California, in South Central LA. If I could do it, you could do it. I said we were all poor, and then I realized I was never poor. I didn't have any money, but I was never poor. Out of bad habits, we pass down bad habits from generation to generation. Out of love, we pass down bad habits from generation to generation. But it's what we don't know that we don't know that's killing us. There's not a welfare mother in this country that doesn't want her child to be successful, intelligent, hardworking, and taxpaying for no other reason than to feel proud of them. But you can't give what you don't have in a blind town, a one-eyed man's king. If you don't know better, you cannot do better. So I'm an entrepreneur today because I saw my daddy be an entrepreneur, because we owned a gas station, an 8-unit apartment building, a nursery, our own home, and a cement contracting business. I saw my dad in a suit on Tuesday going to church, Bible study. I saw him on Sunday going to church. I saw him on Friday making payroll, and I saw every race under the sun receiving a paycheck from my dad, and they didn't see a black man, they saw an employer. So from an early age, I had this concept that I could do whatever I wanted to do, but the kids around me saw prison, probation, parole. They didn't see role models. And so they wanted to be rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers. And this is where I got the difference maker, Don. They wanted to be rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers because they were brilliant. They were modeling what they saw. The success stories they saw in their communities were rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers. They didn't see businessmen in suits. They didn't see a woman the little girls didn't see a woman with a business card and integrity and dignity. And so when I first saw a banker come into my classroom at age 9 years of age in Compton, California, I had 2 questions. Man, what do you do, and how did you get rich legally? Because I had never experienced somebody. I mean, he happened to be a Caucasian banker, but it didn't matter. He cared. He was compassionate. He invested in my life. And so there is no mistaking, there's no accident that, you know, 30 years forward, well, first of all, when I was 10, I started at the neighborhood candy house, borrowed $40 from my mother. Before that, I went to go work at the liquor store, which unfortunately sold candy at the corner. I told the liquor store owner he sold the wrong kind of candy. He said, go away, little boy. I've got a college degree. I said, that's nice. I've got cavities. He wouldn't listen to me. He was arrogant. We'll get to that in a moment. He was arrogant and overly confident, And I went to work for them for 3 weeks to learn how to buy, wholesale, and sell retail. As soon as I learned that, I quit. And I went home and borrowed $40 from my mother, not because she believed in me per se, but because she wanted me to shut up and get off, sort of stop bugging her. And I opened the neighborhood candy house in my den, ate through half the inventory. I hate candy to this day. Sold the other half, had enough money to go back and purchase a whole new inventory, and made $300 a week when I was 10 years old. Now, think about that, $300 a week. Think about what $300 a week would be today. That was 30 years ago. That's probably $1,000 a week. I made $300 a week when I was 10 years old. Then I found girls and lost a business and was becoming a recurring theme in my life. But that proved to me at an early age that I could do anything I wanted to do if I willed it. And I had the power of an idea. And I made that idea real in my life. And I had a role model. And the book, The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, says that if 5% role models, a community stabilizes. Not a black community or brown community or a white community, but any community. The problem in our community is these underserved communities at the role model level is 3.7% or less. So you don't remember, it's too thin. You don't remember, reflect, understand, or appreciate what a professional looks like. That was my story coming up. And my mom and dad divorced over money, went separate ways. And I decided that I didn't want anybody else to grow up in that environment. I decided that I didn't want financial predators taking advantage of anybody else. We lost our home when I was a child to that year's version of a mortgage subprime crisis. But it wasn't just that there were financial predators. I mean, and unfortunately, there should be a consumer regulatory agency, by the way. It needs to also regulate these, what I call these ghettoized financial services. Check cashers, rent-to-own stores, payday lenders. There's renting rim stores, if you can believe that now. You know, the 20-inch rims with spinners on it? I mean, this is just amazing to me. I mean, car rims, folks. Ghettoized financial services is a $10 billion a year industry. More money than made in M&A fees on Wall Street. And it is easier to be a mortgage broker on a street, to be a mortgage broker than it was to be a pimp on a street corner in Harlem because a pimp needed references. Anyway. Always keep humor in the front of your life. I decided that I didn't want that to happen to anybody, and this is from the first chapter of my book, Loss Creates Leaders. That nobody woke up in the morning and said, I want to start a cancer foundation. The people who start cancer foundations are people whose lives have been impacted by cancer, either directly or indirectly. Somebody you love, somebody you cared for. Those who start leukemia foundations, they started because their life was impacted by somebody who had leukemia. I talk in the book about the lady who started Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And she could care less about the issue of drunk driving. She wasn't even very spiritual. But her little blonde-haired, blue-eyed child was hit by a drunk driver and killed. And she was angry with the world, a very natural emotion. And she raised her hands and she rallied against God. And how dare you? Of course, God didn't do it. God gave us free will. We did it. We play God every day. When you drive out in this car and you hit the brake as you get to a light and you stop when there's 20 people walking across the street, you play God. You take your foot off the brake and you hit the gas at that same street light and you've played God, free will. This lady, after she went through these various gyrations of anger, she finally then had depression, and after depression she had what I call surrender. And she said, okay, what could possibly be positive in this thing? What could possibly come out of this negative thing? And she asked the right question. And she got her answer, which was Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which has now probably saved the lives of tens of millions of young people. So you have to ask yourself the question, did her daughter die in vain? Was her daughter a victim? Was her daughter a tragedy? Or was her daughter an angel and a bridge so that she could do well and do good too? That rainbows only follow storms. That we only grow through what I call legitimate suffering. So what does this have to do with reset and why we are here today? What does my life story have to do with this? Why is it relevant that I was a teenage entrepreneur and then I took one too many risks, was arrogant once too often, was homeless for 6 months when I was 18 years of age, and then when I was 19 years of age, started my own business and built it up, and then when I was 25, started Operation Hope, 26, with the Rodney King riots in 1992, with a vision to change the world and to eradicate poverty, another idea. People said it was crazy. Said I was, well, the nonprofit social investment bank. They said literally that I was an oxymoron, a nonprofit social investment bank, and that I was a moron. And people wrote it off and wrote me off as a 26-year-old kid and said it would never work. What they didn't know was that I had been in business for 16 years when I was 26. I started my first business, as I've already mentioned to you, when I was 10. And it's a beautiful thing to be written off, to be discounted, and to be dismissed, because the world leaves you alone to create. We've now raised $500 million to empower the poor. We have 5,000 partners here and around the world. We have 10,000 volunteers who are in 3,500 schools and nonprofits teaching financial literacy, the language of money, and dignity. We have restructured $300 million in mortgages in this mortgage subprime crisis, helping 100,000 people in the crisis, this crisis, as well as 100,000 people in response to Hurricane Katrina. Don has already mentioned we've served 1.2 million people, and with Quincy Jones and Andrew Young, we're on a mission now to reach, teach, and touch 5 million kids to make smart sexy again. And Quincy Jones says it takes 20 years to change a culture. In the last 20 years, we've made dumb sexy. We've dumbed down and we've celebrated it. Think about that. In the next 20 years, we need to make smart sexy again. We've got to make that young kid today see somebody with a suit on and say, I want to be you. You know, there's a TV show that was on for a decade. It was a top of the mark, very well produced. I'm not disparaging the show. It was called Friends. Anybody ever notice that no one's got a real job? Think about it. They live in a $10,000 walk-up in Manhattan. They have the best of clothes. They have a bunch of fun. And nobody's got a real job. So really, have we celebrated work? Have we celebrated what I call hustle? You know, there is the magic of compounded interest, but there's also the magic of compounded hustle. Are we doing the work? An entrepreneur is somebody who works 18 hours a day to keep from getting a job. Are we doing the work? Is that something we celebrate in society? Let's go back now to what it made America great. So again, backwards, present, and then forward. For 100 years, America, by the way, America's not a country, in my opinion. America's an idea. It is the ideal idea. And California and New York, in many ways, are the epitome of that because it's two of the most diverse places on the planet. It happens to be two of the largest economies, the two largest economies in the U.S. as well. So I'm tying diversity not with goody-two-shoes or moral argument or we are the world, ain't that sweet. I'm tying diversity to good, solid business ethics. When you represent everybody, when you relate to everybody, you can do business with everybody. We don't do business with companies or governments. We do business with people. Henry Ford made something called an automobile. Now, I didn't say he invented it, because he didn't. He didn't invent the ball bearings, and he didn't invent the turbine engine. He didn't invent the combustion engine. He didn't invent the windshield. He didn't invent any of these things, but he had enough vision to take all these inventions and pull it together into something called an automobile, and then have the wisdom to pay his workers enough to purchase the cars that they were making. You had a guy named Sam Walton, who created something called Walmart, largest retailer in the world today, who said, let me figure out how to provide quality products at an affordable price for the working poor. You had a guy named Steve Jobs, who created this thing called Apple. And I shall note, he was fired from his own company. Went off to create something called Next, which was next in about 12 years. Didn't work. At least didn't work the way he wanted it to. It was ahead of his time. Came back to Apple. Remember this 20-year cycle I'm talking about. Came back to Apple and is now running Apple and Pixar and is creating products that we love but don't quite understand. Or this guy named Ted Turner. What did he innovate? CNN, 24-hour news. But if you watch the first CNN, it was truly pitiful. I mean, I'm talking about hog shows, that the only interested parties were the hogs. I mean, it wasn't very interesting. But the Bible says, where there is no vision, the people perish. And you can go on and on and on. Mother Teresa was a social entrepreneur. And Dr. Dorothy Height, one of my sheroes, the National Council of Negro Women, was a social entrepreneur. And Dr. King and my hero Andrew Young with the Civil Rights Movement, the Second American Revolution, won it without firing a shot. They were social entrepreneurs. Operation Hope is an idea. The Commonwealth Club is an idea. Bank of the West was an idea. Wells Fargo was someone's idea. Yale University is named after somebody named Yale. Harvard University after somebody named Harvard. The Rockefeller Foundation by somebody named Rockefeller. Are you with me so far? I'm sorry, I've got low self-esteem. Are you with me so far? Remember, from the black church. My point is that these were all the power of the idea. Now let me play something out for you. Maybe capitalism and free enterprise is the business of creating value for people. Maybe, just maybe, there is a difference between profit and productivity. I know these are crazy thoughts. But maybe you should actually have to create some value that's actually long-term and sustaining, where people are better off because of you than when they first met you. And if you do that, and if you create something that creates value, i.e. a CNN, i.e. a CNBC, i.e. a Commonwealth Club, i.e. whatever you want to talk about, then as a result of the power of that idea and people benefiting that idea, you become profitable and wealthy and maybe even powerful. But the profit and the wealth and the power is the byproduct, not the product. You with me? Let's fast forward to today. Let me ask you this. I love this. I love this part. You ask somebody today, why are you in business? What's the answer? I want to make money. Now, I haven't planted anybody in the audience now. Faith is what you do when you don't have all the facts. I love this part. My fourth chapter of my book, Love Leadership, is vulnerability is power. So I'm being very vulnerable here on national radio. You ask somebody, why are you on Wall Street? What's the answer? I'm sorry? To make a lot of money. You ask somebody, why are you a professional basketball player? I want to get paid. I want to get rich. You ask somebody, why are you a rap star? I want to get paid. I want to get rich. You ask somebody, why are you going to college today? I want to do well. I want to make a lot of money. I mean, wherever you turn, it's all about money. What am I saying? We've made the byproduct money, the product. I'll repeat that. We've made the byproduct the product. Back to my book, Love, Leadership, the New Way to Lead in a Fear-Based World. What I'm saying is that love is long-term. Love, if we had treated in this economic crisis, in the mortgage crisis, we treated clients like transactions and not as relationships. If we had treated everybody like a relationship, you wouldn't have a crisis. Let me give a ridiculous sort of example. If you had made a loan to everyone like it was your grandmother, you would not have a crisis. Now, some of you may say, well, John, that's a ridiculous example. Well, it is. I'm making a bold example to make the point, but let's see how ridiculous it is. Your grandmother wants you to get up and out of her house. Your grandmother doesn't want you living with her forever. She wants you to have respect and dignity. Your grandmother wants you to have a reasonable income. So she's going to say, baby, whatever the cost is, charge me for that. Whatever the cost to service it, charge me that. And if there's a reasonable profit that you make, you know, I want you to make some money, a little money, charge me that, but make sure it's something I can live with for the rest of my life. Are you with me? That's no different. That's no different than saying I want to treat you like a relationship and not as a transaction. Fear, though, says, fear is first cousin. Short-termism, it's about me and not about we. It's about greed and it's about laziness. And it's about what do I get? It's about asking the question, what do I get in a world where we should be asking, what do we have to give? Fear is a prosperity killer. And the most dangerous person in the world is a person with no hope. Where are we at today? I'm going to suggest that this is not a recession. Now, about now, you should be thinking that your speaker is a little crazy. Because you're certainly feeling this economically. Let me challenge that. When you have a cold, you have a sneeze. But is the sneeze the cold? No. It's a symptom of the cold. So we're in an economic crisis. You're feeling it. We're in what you call an economic crisis. You're feeling it in your pocket. But that does not necessarily suggest that that is the crisis itself. It could be an indication of the crisis. So if this is not a recession, then what am I suggesting it is? A reset. If this is not an economic crisis, then what am I suggesting it is? A crisis of virtues and values. That if it takes 20 years to change a culture, what kind of culture have we nurtured? There's been a lot of great 20-year periods. The 20 years between 1930, the Great Depression, and 1950, right after World War II, was a transformational period in American history. And by the way, before 1930, you worked from the time you could stand up and you worked until you dropped. The modern social safety net came after the worst depression other than what we're going through right now, which is more of a great recession. But the worst depression that we ever experienced came after that. It was a modern social safety net that gave what is today the, you know, all these protections for youth and for elderly. Social security reform. Social security was a European idea that said you could retire when you're 65, which, by the way, at 65, if you then were not working, the 18-year-old who was not working now gets your job. We, quote, created jobs through the power of an idea called social security. The FDIC was created after the Great Depression. The modern Federal Reserve was created after the Great Depression. But let's fast forward to after World War II. Anybody can tell me what happened right after World War II that just capped all of this? GI Bill was part of it. That actually, GI Bill helped to create the middle class, helped to create a home ownership base in America. By the way, black middle class was created post-World War II through government jobs because it was a level playing field, but I'm not talking about that either. It was the Marshall Plan. Well, we rebuilt countries that had bombed us. Germany and Japan had bombed us, but we recognize the difference between the leaders who did this and the people who were subject to those leaders. And we did not make the masses pay the price for the few. Never. So I was in Davos in January for the World Economic Forum, and the CEO of Deutsche Bank said, "Never can I remember where the actions of so few hurt so many." Back to the example. When we rebuilt Germany and Japan, it gave us gravitas around the world. It gave us credibility. It gave us moral authority. And on the back of that came the global economic system. There was no global economic system before that. That created the road through which we then built this economic system of what I'm calling doing well by doing good. Doing well and doing good. And we've been riding that train for 50 years. And we rode it into a ditch. Rainbows after storms. Where are we at today and what do we go forward? Maybe we needed a crisis. Because I'm not sure I want to live in the world we had 5 years ago. You remember the world? Mass consumerism, all about me, shopping. You know what the definition of an addiction is, don't you? An addiction is basically where you need some outside source and you need more of it today than you had yesterday to give you the same buzz. Whether it's alcohol or drugs or shopping or you're addicted to another person. But your cup doesn't have a bottom. If I don't like me, I'm not going to like you. If I don't feel good about me, I'll never feel good about you. If I don't respect me, I don't know how to respect you. If I don't love me, I can't love you. And if I don't have a purpose in my life, I'm going to make your life a living hell. We've lost our storyline. Everything has a storyline. How did you meet your mate? It's a storyline. How did you end up at your employer? It's a storyline. What are you passionate about? It's a storyline. How did the Commonwealth Club come into existence? It's a storyline. How is Operation Hope created? It's a storyline. The magic of America. Why is America the only race of every nation in the only nation in the world where every race of people within our borders? It's not because we've got great immigration policy. In fact, most folks got here by crawling here illegally, not coming here illegally. And by the way, I'm not talking about Mexicans coming from Mexico. We're all vagabonds. We all of our ancestors, mostly, whether you were the Polish of that day, the Irish of that day, the Italian of that day, The German of that day, 40s, the 50s, the 30s, going back as far as you want. In fact, the early immigrants came through the equivalent of Ellis Island and looked south. I'm talking about mainstream. When I say mainstream, Don, I mean Caucasian. Came through the equivalent of Ellis Island and looked south and saw blacks catching heck. Looked north and saw the emergence of the Industrial Revolution and diversity. Looked south again and said, I'm not black, but why test my luck, and headed north. So the northern growth was not, it wasn't about it wasn't an issue of race and the color line primarily. It was the south resisting northern economic domination. And the north had a diverse model focused on the future and change. But we wanted to live in our comfort zone for some who lived in southern states. I believe that, and here's my closing remarks, and then I'd love to open this up for questions. I believe that if you looked at, and I believe that America, by the way, is the greatest country in the world. With all our problems and all our challenges, I think this is an amazing place. My story alone, I think, proves that this is an amazing place. In many ways, we succeed in spite of ourselves. Where else can you recreate yourself and reimagine and reaffirm and reinvent yourself? But we've got challenges, and de Tocqueville said, about America, and he said it most recently, and it was quoted in this book, The Road from Ruin, by my friend Matthew Bishop, for which Operation Hope is also featured. De Tocqueville said that America's greatest asset is not its preeminence in the world. It's not that it's more enlightened than other nations, but its ability to repair its faults. It's our ability to heal. Life is 10% what life does to you, and 90% how you choose to respond to it. I think success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. I'm giving you my best stuff. It's going right over your head. That my book, Love Leadership, deals with five laws of love leadership. One, loss creates leaders. Two, fear fails. You'll have your 15 minutes. If you are a company or a person that leads by fear, you'll have your 15 minutes. You'll assault your employees, or you'll assault the marketplace, and you will get, because you are a taker, you will get in the short term. But you go far enough in the North Pole, you'll end up south. And Countrywide had its day, but it's gone. Lehman had its day, but it's gone. Most of the predators who did, Ameriquest had its day, but it's gone. 95% of these predatory mortgage lenders are gone. So you get your 15 minutes, and you may actually make a few bucks off of me, but you're going to spend most of your money trying to defend your reputation. I mean, the CEO of Countrywide is a new Enron CEO. I mean, the guy can't cut a break anyway, and he'll be haunted for the next 10 to 15 years, and I believe his net worth will be depleted trying to defend himself, because you cannot buy integrity. And so you'll get your 15 minutes, but the question is, do we want 15 years? The greatest asset for Coca-Cola is not, I mean, let's face it, they're selling colored sugar water. I'm not defacing Coca-Cola. I think it's a great company. But you don't really need colored sugar water. What's Coca-Cola's most premier prize asset? It's its brand. It's reputation. That's one of the reasons they spend so much time in community, so much time reinvesting, so much time building brand equity, so that you, when you pick up a Coca-Cola, as silly as this sounds, you feel good about Coca-Cola. They recently made a commitment. I believe they use 300 billion gallons of water a year making Coca-Cola. They recently made a commitment that in the next 20 years, they're going to return to the universe 300 billion gallons a year in water. So for every gallon of water they use, they want to return a gallon of water. Now, does that make you feel better about buying Coke? I think it does. I think that companies that do well and do good prosper. I think Wells Fargo in Los Angeles is the largest bank within the bank. They also are the largest contributor of charitable funds back to the community in Los Angeles and within their own bank. So they're the largest giver in Los Angeles and the most profitable bank within Wells Fargo nationwide. I believe that they are connected. The 20th century was about, Don's telling me to wrap up, he's giving me the hook, so there's a lot of questions. But let me just say this last thing. The 20th century was about democracy, basically. And so you had India, you had You had Gandhi in India. Because democracy doesn't mean anything to anybody. The only way you commoditize that for the average person is the right to vote, for equal access, and other social justices. So you had Gandhi in India. You had Nelson Mandela in South Africa. This is no accident. You had Andrew Young and Dr. King in the southern states and John Lewis in the southern states pushing the same thing. But today, in 2010, in the backdrop of a global economic crisis, you've got more people today that don't have a bank account that didn't have the right to vote in 1962. 40 million Americans have no bank account in the richest country in the world. And I'll go one step further. In the backdrop of this global economic crisis, rainbows after storms, if you don't understand the language of money, financial literacy, and you don't have a bank account, you're an economic slave. Andrew Young told me, he said, John, Dr. King and I integrated the lunch counter, but we never integrated the dollar. And to live in a system of free enterprise and not to understand the rules of free enterprise is to be a slave. So 20 years, I've been at this 18 years. I'm an overnight success in 18 years. But I believe this is just about working a plan and staying focused and understanding that nothing good comes easy, that love takes work. Non-love is laziness and anti-love is evil. And I think that we have all got to make financial literacy the new civil rights issue and what I call the global silver rights issue. We've got to make free enterprise and capitalism finally work for the poor and the least of these God's children. Because when you get to the pearly gates, God's not going to ask you how many wardrobes you had. He's not going to ask you how many Ferraris that you have in the garage. He's not going to ask you how many vacation homes that you have. He's not going to ask you how many country club memberships that you have. He's not even going to ask you how often you went to church. He's going to ask you, what'd you do for the least of these, my children? And if you're like the one guy who buried the talent, he had one talent and he buried it, God may say to you, depart from me, I never knew you. This is not a conversation about religion, but it is a conversation about purpose and living for something larger and more important than ourselves. And I will say this, that America can once again lead. We're the largest economy in the world, $14 trillion. You can fit every major economy in our economy and still have room. So the world needs us to succeed in the short term. But in the long term, we're going to have to earn that through respect and dignity and being focused on what we have to give in a world obsessed with what we get. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John. We all enjoyed that presentation. The audience enjoyed it very much, and they've overwhelmed you with questions. To categorize the questions, they seem to come in three basic subjects. First one is around the general area of financial literacy. The second would be around sort of our financial crisis and what to do about it. And third, specific to Operation Hope's programs. Yeah. So I thought we'd begin with a question from the audience on financial literacy. And the question basically asks, what are the most important things that we could do today in a concrete way to improve the level of literacy in the U.S.?
I got, with the help of the President Bush, to sign his executive order making financial literacy policy in 2008. President Obama, God bless him, has reaffirmed that executive order, I understand from his administration, Department of Education, that they are going to make financial literacy a requirement for every child, K through 12. Now, there are 17 bills floating through the House and the Senate right now around various forms of financial literacy, one of which is H.R. 1325, which, again, was inspired by Operation Hope, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, that basically says if you get a guaranteed student loan, you must take a course in financial literacy. And if you are a college or university that receives federal funds, you must by law be required to offer a course in financial literacy. I think that you have got to write your congressperson and tell them to pass H.R. 1325. Ask them, are they co-sponsoring H.R. 1325? And we need to get out of this sort of partisan framework when it comes to, I think, you know, every good marriage is made of constructive friction, so let's have a debate. But let's agree without being disagreeable. And on some issues, it's not about whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, because this issue is about the get-it-done party. It's not about the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. This is just good for America. So we need to make sure there are co-sponsors on both sides of the aisle. We need to make sure that your members of Congress know this is important to you. Basically, a member of Congress, when they get a letter from you, they assume that that represents about 6,000 constituents because people don't write letters. People complain, but they don't write letters. By the way, we have spent a long time, almost a generation, being focused on what we are against. We become experts in what we are. We will tell you precisely what we don't like. We've got to become experts in what we are for. So be for H.R. 1325. Be for one of the 17 pieces of legislation that's working its way through Congress. Go in, home and Google search, or Yahoo search, I'm being democratic here, the financial literacy federal legislation. Find the one you like or ones you like and write your congressman and U.S. senator and tell them, and here in San Francisco that'd be Senator Feinstein, tell them that you want them to pass this. It will matter. Write President Obama. Encourage him to make financial literacy a requirement for every child K through 12. This, if we don't do this right, this ties in, Don, to one final thing, which is why I want to really drill home this point. This is a very key question. This ties into the high school dropout rate. 30% of all kids in America, the leading economy in the world, drop out of high school. I didn't say 30% of minority kids. 30% of all kids, 50% of urban kids drop out of high school, and I'm ashamed to say this, but it's the truth, 70% of young black men drop out of high school in America. So when you're walking down the street and you see an 18-year-old young black man, there's a 70% chance that he will or has dropped out of high school. And there's not enough gated communities to save you from a child who has no hope. We have an enlightened self-interest. Dr. King said in the Civil Rights Movement that I'm here to save black men's bodies and white men's souls, that we're all in this together. And so I think that these kids are dropping out of high school while India and China are eating our lunch, by the way. These kids, when I was in China, start school at 7 in the morning, come home at 7 at night, study from 7 to 9, have dinner and go to bed and start it all over again. They are going to eat our lunch, and they should if we don't repair this. But we can solve this, because I think these kids are dropping out of high school because they don't believe education is relevant to their future. I mean, nobody wants a mortgage. Ooh, give me one of those subprime 20% red mortgages. No, they want to become a homeowner. Maybe too badly. That's because they were asking what was the payment, not what was the interest rate, and you never ask what the payment is when there is an interest rate attached. So these kids need to understand that their education is tied to their aspiration. Why is a kid dropping out? They don't think education is relevant to their future. How do you make it relevant? Show a kid how to prosper, how to succeed, and how to do well legally. Financial literacy, free enterprise and capitalism, ownership, opportunity, and entrepreneurship. And if you are a drug dealer, it is unethical and it is immoral, and you need to pay your debt to society. But if you are a successful drug dealer, you are not dumb. You understand import, export, finance, marketing, wholesale, retail, customer service, profit margin, geography, territory, security. You're not talking about a dumb kid. You're talking about a misdirected kid. So we need financial literacy for a range of reasons. But making education relevant and making smart cool is a big one. And so stop today, go home, and write your congressman, your senator, and tell them that this is something that they need to do. And then volunteer yourself. Go in that classroom and be that change maker. Be that 5% that kid grows up and says, I can be you.
Related question, how do you think the U.S. rates with other developed countries in terms of financial literacy?
We are great, and that is bad. We are ahead of most countries other than Russia. Australia does require it for every child. That is something that they did in the last few years. In the U.K., they have actually opened kids' accounts. So if you're a child in the U.K., you get a bank account at birth with £1,000 in it, maybe £1,500, and you can't take it out. Michael, is that right? You can't take it out, but after a period of time, you can use it for your college education. You can reinvest it. But that gives that kid some seed corn. It gives that kid a stake in his or her future. And I think that we need to, in America, by the way, we need to mandate that every kid gets an electronic debit card access, FDIC insured or NCUA, credit union insured bank account or credit union account at birth, to give that kid a sense that they are part of this system. So we are ahead in the sense that we've made it federal policy. We are ahead in the sense of the President's Council on Financial Literacy, for which you served on with great distinction, Don. We're ahead in the sense that the administration wants to make it a federal policy. We are behind in the sense that we should have done this 10 years ago. Imagine what would have happened if 90% of Americans were financially illiterate. We probably would, this crisis would have a bottom, and we would add 1% of GDP, is my guess, on the top end. It would have stopped earlier. It would have been briefer. It would be a recession, not a reset, because 70% of our economy is consumer driven, and you'd have more top end growth. So I think that we need to get on with it. I think that we are so focused on, we're paralyzed right now with fear. The patient is stabilized, but the state still has malaria. The patient has cancer, has HIV. So we need to stabilize the patient. We need to make sure the credit continues to flow to people with less than an 800 credit score. Hello. I'm not for ending subprime lending. I'm saying this publicly now. To want to end responsible subprime lending is stupid. More has been done to lift poor people out of poverty with responsible subprime lending than anything in the last 50 years. The problem has been irresponsible subprime lending, predatory subprime lending, greed-based subprime. By the way, the issue is not the failure of free enterprise and capitalism. It's the failure of greed. And we need to make sure we don't shut off credit to inner cities and low-wealth communities, because a lot of people never want to provide credit to these communities to begin with, and this gives them a good excuse to not do it. And credit won't stop. It's just that Luigi and Boo Boo and the pawn shop will pick it up, and the payday lenders will pick it up, and then the predators will pick it up. So I think, Don, we are doing a good job. We need to make sure this never happens again. And the only way we really do this, and this is Rick Hartnett's idea from U.S. Bank, by the way, to make sure this never happens again, is we need to make financial literacy the new civil right. Every child should be taught the language of money, and we create a new culture over 20 years.
Well, let's segue into questions on what caused the financial crisis. And we have a lot of questions on the financial crisis. One of our listeners asked, do you believe that the Community Reinvestment Act contributed to the crisis by encouraging banks to stretch their lending guidelines?
Nothing stupider. The question is great, but the premise that people have been pushing is stupid. And I want to credit here Greenlining Institute, which is here in San Francisco, and my friends Bob Gnezda. They did more to push CRA, them and the California Reinvestment Coalition and others, than anybody else. And when bankers did this, they didn't want to do it, to be honest. But honest bankers will tell you they were better off. They were, because they made more money on these low-wealth portfolios than they made from others, because there were no competition in the inner city. Not because they were preying on people, because there just weren't anybody else trying to get these customers. But let me go one step further, and let me speak to the specifics of your question. If you look at the details and not the rhetoric, there's one class of people that got more CRA-based subprime loans. Let me rephrase that. Got subprime loans. Let me be very close about it. More of one class got more subprime loans more than every other class combined. More, you take Latinos, Indians, Asians, African Americans, and put them in the same bucket, Don. One group got more loans, subprime loans, than anybody else, and that were white males. Middle class, white males. Don't trust me. Go home and search on the internet. It's a Fannie Mae study. It was done independently, and you'll see the numbers for yourself. Now, that's the truth, but we don't talk about it. We want to blame. It's almost like with Hitler in 1940. Germany was failing. They, versus just saying we screwed up and we failed, and we've been failing since after World War I, when their crisis in Germany started. That economy started failing after World War I, and by the time you got to 1930s, Hitler was jailed as a crackpot in Germany. But by 1939, the economy was so bad that he became a national hero, and by 1940, they were saluting the man with the military and blamed all this on 6 million Jews. It was a bad idea then, it's a worse idea now. And to blame this crisis on minorities, when I joke about this, Don, I say, look, black and brown people don't have $20 trillion to lose. I mean, I was with Andrew Young's the guy who does his gardening, and he's black. And I said to his gardener, I said, "Look, how's this economic crisis affecting you?" He said, "Well, John, I was poor before this crisis. I'm probably going to be poor after this crisis. And the only people I know who are ready to kill themselves are my middle-class white friends. This is a middle-class crisis. This is not a poor person's crisis. And so we're all in this thing together. Yeah.
What is your view of the primary causes of the financial crisis?
Greed and arrogance. Greed, arrogance, short-termism, and massive levels of financial illiteracy. Yes, predators were on top of us. Yes, fraudsters were on top of us. Yes, some of these securitizations were disgusting. Yes, people were irresponsible. All of that is true. But we all did a Madoff. Did you hear me? I'll say it again. We all did a Madoff. We robbed Peter to pay Paul. We lived beyond our means. We bought two of everything that we didn't need. Did anybody ever notice there's no old cars on the freeway anymore? When I was coming up, there were old cars everywhere. I mean, the government was trying to encourage you to get these clunkers off the road. I drove a 1967 Mustang that while it had an Earl Shy plane. Remember the Earl Shy? When you couldn't get a new car, you wouldn't got the old raggedy thing you had. You got to repaint it. And I had these beautiful retread tires on my Mustang, and I just thought I was the coolest of the cool until I was on a hot freeway at 92 degrees, and all four retreads came apart at the same time. But there were clunkers everywhere. You weren't embarrassed because the guy next to you had a big, you know, battle axe. Remember those things? Everybody's driving a new car. So we robbed Peter to pay Paul. We lived beyond our means. We bought two of everything. We paid for it on credit. Our house was our slot machine, and we had no idea how the story was going to end. That is the very definition of a Ponzi scheme. And so, again, I'm suggesting it's a culture issue. It is an issue that this... President Clinton once, I think this is just so brilliant. President Clinton once said, he said, it is hard to get somebody to agree with the truth when the lie is financing your lifestyle.
How can we control corporate greed, and do you think most CEOs are ethical?
I think that most people are ethical. I don't want to, you know, I don't like when people categorize. You know, it's like, oh, Republicans are good. No, you're not. 20% of them are bums. All Democrats are good. No, they're not. 20% of all Democrats are bums. I have bums in my family. Everybody here has a cousin boo-boo. Everybody in here has a cousin you're ashamed of. And if you're really unfortunate, you have an uncle that you don't want left with your children for very long alone. So the reality is we have bums everywhere. I call it the bum factor. And there are 20% of police officers who are bums. Unfortunately, we focus on the 20%, probably less than 20%, versus focus on the, there's 80% who are actually doing an honorable job. And yeah, there's 20% of CEOs who are bums. But I think that this is a culture issue, Don. Again, I keep coming back to the same issue, that we have an entire generation of people who are focused on me and what do I get. And I think that they're financially illiterate as well. I think some of these CEOs are financially illiterate. They don't have a clue what free enterprise and capitalism means and what growing an economy is. I'll give you one quick example. There's a company, a great company, employs 2,000 people, is doing well, but a company decides to short its stock. And so the company CEO says, I made $50 million today. Really? You made $50 million. How'd you make that? Well, I shorted company XYZ. So let me make sure I understand this properly. Company XYZ, which was otherwise healthy, otherwise paying its bills, otherwise producing a product, otherwise retaining people who were financing the economy through their taxes and consumer spending, that company's now in a free fall, may be out of business, and may file bankruptcy. You've made $50 million. But there was a company that was a market maker in that company's stock on the other side who now is down $50 million. You didn't make $50 million, you transferred $50 million. It was a transfer of wealth, not a creation of wealth. We have got to get our storyline back and stop playing these short-term only games.
What's your view of the current legislation that's proposed to protect the consumer in Washington?
I think that democracy is a great system or a horrible system except for every other system. And I think that for those of my friends, so first of all, let me say we need the consumer regulatory protection or something like it. I mean, Stevie Wonder can see this. This is not complicated. And Stevie Wonder's a friend. He wouldn't mind me saying this. By the way, Stevie Wonder drives a car, which is a whole other story. He probably can see better than all of us combined through his senses. But I think that you know, some of my friends will say, my private sector friends will say that government is bad. But what I say to them is, you cannot choose to socialize your losses and privatize your gains. You get what I'm saying? You can't choose to socialize your losses and privatize your gains. You cannot choose when you want to pick capitalism. Let me go to a model. New York City, the anchor for free enterprise and capitalism arguably in the world. Agreed? It doesn't work without a subway system. A subway system is a public investment. Police and well-being and gutters is a public investment. Education is mostly a public investment. And so New York does not work without the public investment that facilitates the private sector enterprise. So I'm all for free enterprise and capitalism, but we need to find some balance. And I think that capitalism without bumpers is going to create a wreck. And we have seen that. And so I think that we had a system of almost completely no checks and balances whatsoever. And frankly, captains of industry had an opportunity to prove that that model worked. Right or wrong, Don, they screwed it up. And so now you're going to see what I call an overcorrection. There's going to be too much legislation and too much regulation. And if we're not careful, it will shut off credit. And we've got to find that beautiful thing called balance. And so what I tell CEOs is, don't fight consumer regulation. When you're being run out of town, get in front of the crowd and make like a parade. Work with the administration. You like that one, huh? Work with the administration and try to find a way to make this legislation good for everyone, including yourself.
Thank you, John. Let me remind our audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is John Hope Bryant, founder, chairman, and CEO of Operation Hope, who is discussing financial literacy in America.
Let me make this statement for your next question. Let me make this clear. I believe that we've got to make free enterprise and capitalism work for the poor. I think that if Dr. King was alive today, this would be the work he would be doing. Financial literacy and economic empowerment and ownership. That communism failed because it could not create a middle class. Capitalism succeeded precisely because it did create a middle class. The failure is we stopped there, and we never made free enterprise and capitalism relevant to the poor. And we created the wrong culture, and we've got to repair our breach. So I want to make it very clear: I am for free enterprise and capitalism, but we have never tried to use free enterprise and capitalism as a vehicle to eradicate poverty, and we need to give it a try.
John, we just have time for a few more questions. One of our listeners notes that you have had experience working with three different American presidents and their administrations. Can you contrast their styles?
Sure. Our first black president, Bill Clinton. Well, and I say that because Bill Clinton grew up amongst African Americans in Hope, Arkansas. If you know his story, he was basically raised by a surrogate black grandmother, and I mean, he was very comfortable in the black community. And so I think that's why, by the way, he relates so very well to black America. I think that Bill Clinton is probably the best public servant president that I have had a chance to know. That whether you like Bill Clinton or you don't like Bill Clinton, whether you like his policies or you don't, one thing is absolutely certain: when you talk to him, he's not playing a game with you. You have this sense that he is authentic. And my word in 2008, Don, was authenticity. My word in 2009, because I liked it so much, was authenticity. My word today is to be present, presence. And I don't think many people are present. When you're talking to Bill Clinton, it's as if you're the only person on the planet. I think the guy is absolutely brilliant, but I think his most amazing quality is that he's passionate. I mean, he's absolutely passionate about what was 3 days after bypass surgery, 2 days, he was out there saying, let's go rebuild Haiti. You know, the guy is just absolutely amazing. And I think a saint is a sinner that got up. So I prefer to focus on all the good things that he, and frankly, not only do
we're
I-
down to our last minute, yeah, John. Okay. I don't want to leave those other two guys out.
Not only do I want to focus on the good things that he does, but I think that he wouldn't have done as many good things if he hadn't had those challenging experiences, again, rainbows after storms. President Bush was an action guy. I think he would be defined by a simple phrase: PhDs are good, PhDs are better. He was all about action. Now, maybe it was ready, fire, aim sometimes, but he was all about action, and I never questioned his intent. I actually liked him as a person, and we always had spirited debates. I remember one thing, Tom, he told me, he called me, his nickname for me, he had a nickname for everybody, his nickname for me was Johnny Boy, and I said that's really great, Mr. President, as long as you never forget the Johnny part. You guys are slow. And President Obama, I think, is the most brilliant politician of the 21st century on the planet. I think that as a politician, that doesn't come any brighter, any smarter. I think that he is getting his Lost Creates Leaders credentials on the job. So I guess I'll end with this by saying, when I was advising President Bush, I didn't like sort of some of the things that were going on, and Andrew Young asked me how my meeting was going with the president, and I said, well, I don't know, I'm a little frustrated. And he got frustrated with me, and he said, John, be skeptical, but don't be cynical, because to be cynical is to lose hope. He said, assume that President Bush is a good man with bad counsel, and you go in there and give that man good counsel, and you wait for the political opportunity to make him look good. And that's how I try to live my life, that we don't get six presidents, we get one. One at a time. And when they win, we win. When they fail, we fail. To root for their failure is to root for your own. That's the beauty of America.
Our thanks to John Hope Bryant, founder, chairman, and CEO of Operation Hope. Let's give John a round of applause. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Don McGrath, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.